Okay.
I'm also against urban sprawl, but I'm very concerned about filling in all these spaces that you talk about in these slab farms, which is going to do away with green space. What do those people do to rest their minds and their eyes when they don't have something green to look at or to walk in? At this time of year, of course, we don't have too many daylight hours, but in the summer we have 14, 15 hours where people can use those spaces. And I find that very concerning. Do you have any comments about that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, this is about creating more green space that people can use and less green space that drives people apart. The grassed and forested areas between buildings, between multiplex buildings in the suburbs, are not welcome green space that people use for recreation. They are forbidding spaces that frighten people and keep people away at night. You can create a lot more green space that people use by increasing the population density of a residential district. And if you see what the successful examples of this look like, I mean, the main principle of any green space or public space is that there should be a sense of ownership of it. You want to maintain the green belts, which is a whole other thing. You want to make sure that the cities of Canada maintain their rural transition boundaries, or green belts, as we call them in Toronto, and that sort of thing, so that you're not developing on those, because it's terrible, not just for ecological and green space reasons, but because it's for human and economic reasons. It's terrible for cities to have to lay new infrastructure out across low-density, single-family residential neighborhoods when that's not the problem. And I would say that both the markets and the politics of Canadian cities are against further sprawl. But I would say that also both the politics and the markets are in favor of good public green spaces. And you can do a lot with a neighborhood by taking those dead spaces between buildings. The famous urbanist Jane Jacobs, she once told me in the 1990s that she got into the thing she was doing when she visited the opening of a public housing project in about 1956 in Philadelphia. And she was sitting there in the project looking at the architectural renderings with the architect who designed it. And there were all these grassy spaces between the public housing buildings. And on the renderings, it showed these little circles and clusters of people sort of randomly stand. If you've ever seen an architectural rendering, you know what I mean. These clusters of people sitting around and talking to each other or whatever they're meant to be doing in those fields. And she said to the architect, it's all empty. This pleasant grassy area, there's nobody in there. Where's all the little clusters of people in your rendering? And he had no answer. And then she realized that they had all walked over to the old Victorian neighborhood that was being demolished, and they were all sitting on the front steps of the old houses and talking to each other because it was a better social space. A grassy space that doesn't feel safe and that feels like a dividing place that people are hiding in is not a community space. So we need to recognize that we can have a much more green city if we have spaces that actually suit the needs of people rather than that just separate buildings from each other.
Or not?
Is that thing on?
Is it on now? There we are. Okay. So given what you were talking about, trying to create a greater link between the outer suburbs and the central city and better transportation for people who live in the outer suburbs, what is your opinion of the Scarborough subway?
There will probably be a point when the Scarborough subway is useful. It probably, even if I'm very healthy and fit, will not be during my lifetime, and I'm middle-aged. And it might be during my children's lifetime. It's not a terrific investment, and it's a huge waste of money. And it will be difficult to build up density around it enough to justify it. I should point out that, and I would prefer they spend it on other things, that said, I think we're focused a bit too much on that one white elephant project. when we have actually existing transit lines that have problems with extremely low density around them. And I would point to the Bloor line as being actually an area that suffers that from much of it, except for the very downtown part, that suffers from low population density. When you fly into Toronto on an airplane, and you're lucky enough to have one of those ones that flies over Lake Ontario and over the city to Pearson, you can see the entire Yonge line. Because there are these clusters of apartment buildings with lots of families living in them around every station. And there's a high population density around every station. You can't see much of the Bloor line when you fly over. Because we had councils and we had political situations, and frankly we had also some realities in the housing market. We had housing surpluses in the late 70s and early 80s that forbade the development of high-density apartment dwellings around any subway station should have a lot of apartment buildings around it. That makes sense for people to be living close together near a rapid transit link. But because of the politics of the 1970s and 80s, the Bloor line stations are only now beginning to develop the type of housing and the numbers of families that they should be. I mean, they're turning Honest Eds into many hundreds of rental units, certainly is the type of development we should be seeing all up and down that line. So before we even talk about blowing new lines out into low density areas, we should talk about that. But certainly, if you look at that map of where poverty is and where immigration is in Toronto, yes, that Scarborough subway line is a little slice of that, but we need to be servicing those places. And that includes creation of new lines in central Toronto as well, because the people who live in those low-density, high-immigration, high-poverty inner suburban neighborhoods that don't have any rapid transit links, I mean, they're coming into the center of the city to work and that sort of thing. So we need to recognize those connections are important. But there certainly are many parts of Toronto that are not Scarborough Center, where Toronto is a place where you visit on a weekend every few months if you're lucky, because of the difficulty of the transit link. So yes, of course there are many better priorities than that one. But if it causes the political balance to be okay and things not to tip over into weird populism again, it might be okay as an investment.
Where am I? Right here? There we go.
Your ideas on population density require long-term planning horizons. Are the various levels of politicians in Canada up to the task?
The funny thing is, if somebody said that in the United States, they would be like laughed out of the room and that sort of thing. At least there's sort of hesitant laughter when you said that. There are a lot of government departments in Canada at the federal level and the provincial level and the municipal level that do population growth planning as part of what they do, that have more or less sophisticated plans for future population growth and what to do and how to build their institutions. Those departments don't talk to each other or share those things. Infrastructure departments, immigration departments. The best population growth planning models are those done by the major municipalities in Canada. Toronto has very sophisticated models of exactly how many people are going to be living here over the next 50 years and where they're likely to live and what's required. Those do not line up with anything the province has. And there's little coordination. The federal government is about to launch a big infrastructure bank program to invest in infrastructure. Almost every government we've had in the last half century has had a major infrastructure program. We do not know whether that is coordinated. I would have preferred if that was brought out along with a larger population growth plan so that our infrastructure investments, both on the private and public sector, are attuned to where people are going to be living and need to be living. So they look at not only the fact that Toronto and Vancouver are going to double in size even if we have anti-immigration policies, but that the second tier cities with universities in them, the Hamiltons, Kitchener-Waterloos, Lethbridges, Trois-Rivières, Kingstons, and so on, are going to become major places because they're where people want to immigrate into because they have universities and affordable housing, and should be looking at that. I don't know whether that type of planning is going on. I've even asked the minister, and it got a vague answer. And of course, there's a risk that infrastructure, big federal infrastructure programs, will go where they've gone before, which is to rewarding people who voted for the right party, which may sometimes coincidentally create the right infrastructure in the right places, but it's an inefficient way to do infrastructure planning. I know that there's the thinking in there in a lot of departments, but I would like to see a coordinated interagency, interdepartmental, and multiple level of government plan for population growth. I mean, as I point out in Maximum Canada, between 1945 and 2015, our population tripled, and we did it by luck rather than skill. We did not expect it to happen. In the 40s, we had a huge debate where all the great thinkers of Canada said it should never happen, it'll turn us into a blasted wasteland, we'll run out of food and become Americans. And we were lucky that we had the right housing and the right jobs in the right places for the right people at the right time. And I'm partly arguing that we cannot just get lucky if in the next 80 years our population doesn't even triple, even if it doubles. We need to get skilled because we no longer have the right housing in the right places. We have great economic needs. Our immigrants are employers rather than employees. They're entering a different economy and a different housing market, and we need to have coordinated multi-government, multi-level planning on this, and we need to treat future population growth as something as serious as anything else in Canada. I would say the most serious thing.
Could you summarize the benefits of an increase in population, as I believe your book proposes, to 100 million people for Canada?
Well, the key chapter in this new book is called The Case Against 100 Million. So, but what that argues is that, as I just said, we need to look at population growth as something that's going to happen, not as something... If we were to somehow have the type of politics that froze Canada's population... Not only would it be economically devastating and destructive, it would cause a huge rise in poverty and inequality, it would make an ecological transition to a green economy impossible and unaffordable, and it would be disastrous. And part of what I argue is that there are investments we need to make ahead of population growth in housing supply, in income support for a more fragmented labor market, in skills recognition, in infrastructure, in green technology, and so on. But interestingly, even if we somehow did have that type of politics that froze our population at 35 million or 36 million now, we would still need to make all those investments for our children and for future generations. And that we should develop a 100 million mindset. We should think, I mean, even if we do nothing, even if we just sort of stay steady as we are, we'll be something like 80 million by the end of this century. And yes, I do argue that we should do population growth sooner rather than later because the world population will stop growing at around that time and it'll be much harder. The supply of skilled people and people willing to move internationally will start running out. So we should make it a project sooner rather than later to get to a sustainable population. But that even if we don't do that, we should be doing the things that we'd be doing for population growth. It's a useful policy and thinking exercise to assume that our population will triple by the end of the century. Because there's a good chance it will. B, even if it doesn't, all of the things we need to be doing for that eventuality are things we need to be doing even without that eventuality. So it's a good way to frame our thinking about investments in the country, is to assume there's going to be a lot more of us, even if there aren't.
Thank you for this, Doug. This has been really excellent. I'm really quite interested in the demand for skilled workers that you... I mean, you talked about we'll get to a world where skilled people won't move. And that implies that the kinds of people that you expect we should be looking for to come and add us up to 100 million are skilled people. And yet you also said earlier that right now there's a lot of openings for low-skill, low-wage employment, and there are very few for the most skilled areas, and so many of those skilled people come in and drive cabs and so on. So how do you see the demand for their services growing to give us that better balance that seems to be implied?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we have big shortages in skilled people in Canada, right? I mean, there are businesses in Western Canada that are shutting down 1 week per month and so on because of skilled labor shortages. So that is an issue. We do need X-ray technicians and civil engineers and that sort of thing. We also have big shortages in... There really is hardly any unskilled work anywhere in the world anymore, but in semi-skilled areas. I mean, even the most unskilled job on the oil patch in Alberta requires a college diploma. So factory jobs require college diplomas now because you're operating a robot. And we do also have shortages in those areas. But the thing about people with advanced degrees driving taxi, and if you've ever talked to your taxi driver in Toronto, you know that very few taxi drivers have only one university degree. That has more to do with the fact that we don't recognize their educations and skills. And this is a topic in Maximum Canada. If you come to Canada with a professional degree, you're going to need a couple years of post-secondary to bring it up to Canadian credentials. If you come with a trade, you're going to run headlong into the problem that our trades are still pretty backward in recognizing trade credentials from overseas, and you may end up working under the table for a long time. The problem is that our community colleges and universities are very good at offering a couple years of education to get a foreign law degree or medical degree or teaching degree up to Canadian credential standards, but very, very few people who settle in Canada can afford 2 years of non-income earning when they're trying to support their children's educations to get those credentials, and we're very bad at supporting that. A lot of people do end up deciding, I'm just going to drive taxi and maybe work at my friend's shop and do some buying and selling of products from the home country, and what the development economists call a portfolio of the poor, to make my living, and I'm going to throw away that expensive education so that my kids will be able to make it. The kids do, to an overwhelming degree. The children of immigrants do very well in education and language acquisition and all that, but we throw away a lot of qualified people. And I think even in a high-tech economy with a lot of automation and robotics and artificial intelligence, that will remain a concern. But it will become a bigger concern because we want to be the country that masters and creates and exports that artificial intelligence and robotics and so on, not a country that's subject to it. And we want to have the clusters of skilled and entrepreneurial people. We've got to get out of the mindset where we think of an immigrant as being a unit of labor to be plugged into a factory or a farm or a shop. Immigrants are not units of labor anymore. They are creation of employment. They're four times more likely than native-born Canadians to create a business that will employ people and tend to come from entrepreneurial backgrounds. And we waste a lot of that. We waste it partly because we think of them as units of labor and partly because we don't create the opportunities for business creation that happen. Refugees are units of employment. If you look at the first wave of sponsored refugees in Canada, the Hungarians in 1956, The number of them who ended up starting businesses that employed more than a couple hundred people is huge. One of them started a bit. One of those refugees started a business that employs 40,000 people. And you find that the Vietnamese and the former Yugoslavians and so on followed a similar path. There are good reasons to believe the Syrians will too.
One of the major issues we have in our city right now is lack of affordable housing. And I just want to know if you've considered any solutions to that problem.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of what I was talking about there in terms of reforms to low-density neighborhoods, which I don't regard as a side thing, I regard it as the main challenge of Canada, have to do with the creation of a housing supply that will be sufficient for population growth. And it helps as an exercise to think of our housing supply problem as being one that needs to address future population growth, because then we start to understand the nature of it. But yes, we need to build up housing within where we live, and we need to create incentives to create housing with mixed forms of tenure and mixed prices that will allow for the development of families. It's extraordinary the degree to which new Canadians still buy housing, despite technically not being able to afford it. And people will continue to settle in places that they can't afford to live, because those are better places to settle. I often say, when I've done analyses of why immigrants choose to settle in a particular city or a particular place, there's always three things they look for. One is known opportunities of employment or small business creation. And that means they're exchanging text messages with people in this cities where neighbors of theirs have emigrated to, saying, do you know about a job? Here's a place where they need some shops selling this and that, and they don't have many. Here's a place where this type of business will thrive. Number two is clusters of people from the same cultural and linguistic background who can help them out and loan them money and help them integrate and so on. And then the third thing is housing they can afford. And the one thing that everyone will always drop off that list is the third thing. People will happily settle somewhere where you can't afford to live if you have networks of people to help you and you have known economic opportunities. And we see that everywhere. Immigrants coming to Europe don't settle in Portugal or Bulgaria, even though both those countries are right next to the countries of emigration. They fly over those places to go to places that have economic booms and networks of existing immigrants like Germany and France and that sort of thing. Two-thirds of all immigration to Canada is still in metropolitan Toronto and Vancouver, and probably will be for a very long time, because people will happily live where they can't afford. People will happily live with the whole family in two rooms, because a place where the housing is affordable, usually there's a reason why the housing is affordable, and that usually means there's no economy.
Is it working? Oh, thank you. Doug Saunders, I want to say thank you to you for an absolutely magical presentation, taking us through such a sweep of Canadian history and presenting us with so much that we didn't know. As you said, it's not the official line. And thank you, too, to the congregation for sponsoring this opportunity. I wish your talk could be heard by so many more people than it probably will be, partly because you don't have the time. My question is going to take us back to that very early part, and it's small, it's personal, but one of the reasons I believed that migration was coming from the States is that my own grandfather, Quigley, came with his cart and oxen from Nebraska. He was a farmer, and he came to Saskatchewan to homestead. And I wondered if that was, in your research, that appeared anywhere. Likewise...
What year was that?
The 1890s.
Yeah.
Likewise, we were told our sister province of Alberta, all those cattlemen were Americans. So that slightly surprised me, because it went against the grain of what my small mm-hmm. knowledge from personal history suggested. But thank you again. It's a wonderful, important step forward, and I sure hope you can talk to people with power.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm not going to get into the details of moves across the Canada-US border because it's an interesting and complex history that the averages show one thing, but there's always very interesting exceptions. And in the late 1890s, we started to see a large, the period between about 1896 and 1914 was the one period where we saw a net movement of Americans northward, which didn't happen again until after the Second World War. Okay, I should say, I will be sitting at the book table, happy to sign some books if you have further questions that don't get addressed here, because I believe this has to be the last one.
Okay, thank you. I agree with the comments of the previous questioner about how this is a great presentation. We have an interesting example right in this neighborhood. You mentioned a couple of things. One was the lack of development around subway stations, which is unfortunate, and also the fact that the approval process depends a lot on people who currently live in the neighborhood rather than prospective residents. Within about 5 to 7 minute walk of the Lawrence subway station, there have been two developments that have been hotly opposed by local residents, one on 41 Chatsworth and one on 250 Lawrence West. And the local councillor, unfortunately, has supported the LPRO in that area. What thoughts do you have on, is there any likelihood in future of moving away from this approval system that it depends so heavily on current residents? And also, any thoughts you'd have on how to motivate those local associations to take a broader view of what's needed for Toronto rather than such nimbyism?
Well, I mean, I'm a realist on these things, and I know how politically difficult it is to create change in those areas. The province is not going to all of a sudden say, let's allow development based on principles of population growth rather than on neighborhood approval, as much as they should, because you just politically don't do that. Everybody sees their house as a portfolio investment and thinks, oh, if there's a rental unit next door or in my garage shed or something like that, then that's going to be bad. I mean, I think realistically what's going to push that change is going to be a change in the demographics of housing. And as I said, when I look at some of the better off neighborhoods in Toronto, there's suddenly a shift towards seeing, for example, people turning their garage shed into a two apartment unit as not being the invasion of the rental people into the neighborhood, but as being, that's my kids. Or, a funny story, we moved into a house four streets over to where, we live in the Christie Pitts area, we moved into a house four streets over because it was a little larger and it had a basement that could be converted into an apartment, which mainly our thought was, when our kids get into university age and beyond, they might need a place to live. So I actually said to our kids, I said, you know, we're going to do some work on the basement to make it something that could in the future, it'll be a nice rec room, but could be converted into apartment, because one of you guys might want to live there for a while someday. And my son said, Dad, are you kidding? You're going to be old. We're going to live in the house. You're going to be down there. And you multiply that by a lot of families, and suddenly the political will for infill development in residential neighborhoods becomes may create a political shift, and hopefully we can help that move more quickly. And on that note...